Good afternoon, everyone. Thank you for being here at the Poetry Center. We have John Keane with us today from across the country, and he's also going to be doing a reading that the Poetry Center is co-sponsored for tomorrow night at Green Apple Books. Their new store, which is in the Sunset District, 9th and Irving in the former LaVideo spot. So be there. If you know of somebody who wanted to be here today and couldn't make it, let them know. You know, I think it's going to be a nice opportunity. He's also going to be interviewed tomorrow night by Tan Khan Kao, who's a wonderful reader and bookseller and visual artist, who was one of the first people who turned me on to the existence of this new book of John's, which is Counter Narratives. He's the author of the three books that I'm aware of. There's probably other material out there floating around, but Annotations came out some 20 years ago from New Directions, which is autobiographically based fictions. St. Louis figures prominently, family history. And this book, which is a collaboration with the visual artist Christopher Stackhouse, which is called Seismosis, a book of poetry. And the new book is Counter Narratives. And it is from New Directions as well. It is really just one of the most remarkable books that I've read in years. I mean, it's one of the very few books that I've set down after I finished reading and immediately wanted to start again and come back in and stay in the activity that he's doing. And I've been carrying around this book. It's called The Undercommons: Fugitive Planning in Black Study, by Stephen O'Harney and Fred Moten. I've been carrying it around for about a year now in my bag. It's riddled with pencil marks and so forth. But when I think about fugitive planning and black study, it seems to me that that's the activity of this book, Counter Narratives. And there's a recent review by Doug Miller in Conch magazine, which is Ishmael Reed's longstanding magazine that is now online. And it's printed in like 2-point type or something. But there's a passage here from Doug that says, "Fugitive tales are told from the thickets, and Counter Narratives is a fugitive book full of fugitive tales. Beginning in 1612 with Juan Hernandez, the first documented non-Native American, Afro-Latino, European settler to live and trade on Manhattan Island. That's the only one you're getting." So he's revealed who that is through some research, through some black study. "Walking through high grass in a clearing in Manhattan. Keene's language is a machete slashing through the underbrush of the history of Western civilization, quote, tearing the white out by giving voice to the marginalized, all the way to a basement in a none too distant future in the story Lions," which closes the book. "Along the way, the book whispers in the code of those in bondage. Coded language, coded names, coded text, coded bodies, and secret spaces all play pivotal roles in the passages of Keene's fugitive journey." If you haven't picked up this book, Counter Narratives, you owe it to yourself. I think the paperback will be coming out sometime in the spring, so it's going to be very widely available. Wonderful work. Please welcome John Keane.
So I want to begin by, I often do, thanking everyone for being here today. It's a lovely afternoon, a lovely warm afternoon. I know San Francisco has many different microclimates, but I was told that usually this part of San Francisco is nice and cold at this time of year, so that the fact that it's nice and sunny and you all are here is something I really appreciate. And I want to deeply thank Steve Dickinson and the Poetry Center at San Francisco State for inviting me. It's a tremendous honor to be here. I thought that what I would do is read a story, since I'm at the Poetry Center, but since this book is a book of prose, I would read a story that is very much a short story, but as you will hear as I read, there's a lot of music and, in fact, poetry in it. And one of the things that a number of reviewers have pointed out is that throughout this book, there's a lot of poetry woven through. And interestingly enough, when I was writing many of these stories, I kind of had in the back of my mind, always, of course, a deep and profound sense of language, But rereading many of them aloud, I can really hear the poetry or various kinds of poetries coming through. So you'll definitely hear those in this story. So this story is called Cold, and it's about a guy named Bob Cole. And so I'll just say a few things. It was inspired by sheet music that a friend of mine named Dorothy Wong found online. I think it was the Baylor University Library's sheet music collection. And she found these really outrageous, you know, minstrel songs and performances that were kind of documented there. And so she told me about it, and I thought, who is this person? And it turns out that Bob Cole was the author. He was an extraordinarily prolific author, composer, performer, but he was the person who wrote the song Under the Bamboo Tree in the 1944 film Meet Me in St. Louis that Judy Garland sings with, I think it's Margaret O'Brien, and they do the famous cakewalk. And so I thought I have to kind of learn some more about him. And so then what I did learn was that he had a very tragic end. So this story is about the last few, I guess last day down to the last few minutes of Bob Cole's life. And one last thing I'll say is you can't see it, you can't hear it, but throughout the text there are these little text boxes with his snippets of his songs. So I guess in someday, if I can figure out how to do this, I can actually perform this, not just read it, but perform it with a little snippets of song coming in. Okay. Cold. It's fastest, someone once warned you, when you let go. Here in the sweltering dining room, you recognize no one, not a soul. Your mother took her supper at the usual hour and has already returned to her room. When you've come with her before or alone, you've usually spotted at least one familiar face from the city or Philly or Baltimore, since from June through the first turning of the leaves, people arrive every weekend from all over. Like several other hotels in Catskill, Miss English's has welcomed you, your mother, almost all who pay, permitting stays without incident. There have, however, been a few. Whenever one of them, who has no clue about how the subtler rules this side of the Mason-Dixon line function, how the law sometimes falls on the other side. There was at one time in the hotel on Cowderskill, when you were asked to vacate your room and move to the other wing because the Carolinian took grave offense that you shared the same linens and dishes, that you might brush against his wife in the hallway or stairwell, as if you could not walk a straight or even angled line away from her, as if you had no will, as if you ever cast a second glance at her or any white woman. And that hotel's owner, a round, pasty little man with a voice like a duck call, had said he wanted to avoid any trouble, please just go. He'd throw in a free whiskey as consolation. That afternoon, in what felt like a stupor, you had packed up and settled into your new chamber over here, from which you could see the creek and the mountains instead of your previous ampler river view, the one you'd reserved half a year in advance, and you fumed for a while until a bar, oh yes, Lord, then the full song belled in your head and you spent the entire afternoon in bed scoring it. Even here, you know better than to linger when the dancing begins or challenge one of them on the tennis court. The New Yorkers, city dwellers, or upstaters, native or immigrant, do not so much as blink when they see you, staring mainly at the cut of your full dress suits and shoes, your mother's elegant day ensembles and summer gowns, as if viewing an exhibit. Only one or two of them has ever known whom they were looking at, or for that matter, uttered more than a simple slur. The surface appears tranquil. Beware the undertow. The tan hand slides the bowl of soup beneath your chin. You return what feels like a smile but almost isn't. Vicious. For the last month or two or five, has it been a year? Why can you not remember these newest melodies you cannot flush from your head like a player piano with an endless roll scrolling till infinity?
Songs have always come, one by one or in pairs, dozens. You set them down to paper, to poetry, like when you took the solemn melody of the spiritual Rosamond was whistling as you walked up Broadway and in your head and later on musical paper clothed it in brand new robes. Then somewhere along the way, after the first terrible blues struck, you tried to hum a new tune, conjure one. You thought it was just exhaustion, your mind too tired to refresh itself as it always had. That's why the old ones wouldn't go away. A few memory games, like rambling inside the rooms of your vast mental castle on the Nile, as you called it, and the one song that resulted from it, filling each one with various quilts of harmonies from throughout your life, the sound of an engine starting, horses galloping up the road, boat horns from the direction of the Hudson. Keys to release you from the musical bondage, from any of a thousand things you spot and listen to as you stroll up 136th Street. All the conversations, personal or overheard, hymns, ditty stomps, work songs, quadrilles, cakewalks, rags. None of these could dispel these new ones until they did. Then more appear, stuck as if a band has struck up the opening notes of Black 400 in your skull and decided to keep playing it forever. We have your trials here below. What's a poor brother to do? You fear you can sometimes hear the upper octaves combining towards a crescendo that, soon as you open your mouth, might explode. Close your eyes and lay your head back. For a few seconds, you recline in your seat, suppressing a cry, rise, eyes shut, after only a few spoonfuls. Your fingers trace cannons around your temples. You should head up to your mother's room and tell her that it's getting worse again. Let her minister to you. She used to know how to calm you down with words, a touch. Mrs. Isabella, he's rattling on about something can no one understand. Settle what between your ears only once in a while back in the day became a racket. You should hurry to the phone in the alcove and call the operator and have the operator connect you to Rosamond or his brother Jimmy, your big sister down in Atlanta. Call Aida Walker or Burt Williams, whose traveling schedule you can't remember, though you wrote down the dates in your notebook, even Erlanger or Clow. You at least leave word for them all. It wouldn't take that long for someone to drive up or hire a car or take the elevator to Grand Central and be here before the night is out. Fact is, you should not have told the attendants at the Manhattan State Hospital for the Insane you were free of the interminable internal bellowing. You should not have assured them you'd be fully in Mrs. Isabella's care. That the tempest of those songs had died down, these ones like January storms that grind on all through the morning and evening, so persistent and fortissimo, at times you can feel them chattering like piano hammers along your crown. As you stand at the table, you recall that moment when you couldn't stop caterwauling them. Sometimes you're on the floorboards. How the neighbors banged on the walls, the front door, gathering on the stoop as they came and carried you downstairs saying, Mr. Cole, you all right? Poor thing, you know he wrote The Girl with Dreamy Eyes. I'ma pray for the man. Everybody can see how bad off he is. My sis saw his Sambo Girls Company in Hartford, and just keeping them in line's what broke him in two. Inky Dink sold his soul to you-know-who to line them damn pockets. All those comments tipped with interest, yes, and cheek, contempt twin with compassion to the accompaniment of that sonorous, infernal drone. Devil's arias, you penned them, showfuls. In your 20s, it had all flowed so easily. You'd seal the deal, the singers, the wisecracks, the dancing, all those godforsaken songs, that cooning and crooning minstrelsy, copping a mountain of green in return, concreting a vision of you, all of you in their heads, your own, the nigger who could do no wrong with the Creole show, the All-Star show, and later Black Patty's Troubadours, before you turned it inside out again, alone and with Rosamond, his brother Jiminy. All these songs, unlike the previous ones, these were yours, nothing to feel the slightest pang of shame about. Any colored person could whistle them without a pause, did whistle them as you heard yourself on the IRT. So easily, until these newest ones, undreamt, unsummoned, sonic suns blasting behind your eyes, these terrible samplings of the old and unfamiliar. You should have told the attendants how your agent and the publishing firm's representatives had said in almost the exact same words about your newest pieces, Bob, what has gotten into you? These notes together don't make any melodic or harmonic sense. how the arranger had cackled with reproach. Cole, you got 4 or 5 different polyrhythms running concurrently. No man can play this. How Rosamond himself whispered, this side of sorrow, as he clasped your hand. Bob, this mess on the other side of sound. Everyone began to train the same look on you. The bank cashier, the postman, the barber, the Bajan shoeshine, the tiny boy black as a crow with the crowbar who cranks cars for a cent on Lennox, the humpback beggar guarding the curb hollering, Mister, you need my help? As you sat there on the front steps trying to massage the rondos out of your brow, your sinuses, your freshly trimmed and pomaded locks, trying to express them out. Mister, you need me to call somebody? Excuse me, officer, but I think that gentleman sitting over there humming and crying to himself need... Allow the foliage below an easy embrace. You mop your forehead free of the film of sweat. The August heat is pasted there. Wipe the dew from your chest's silver curls, crumpling the napkin beside the untouched knife and fork. Somehow the heat down in Mississippi, Georgia, Florida, like this interior clamor, has followed you north. Everyone around you is fanning themselves, reclining on benches or couches, already displaying like the underarms of your violet linen suit the dark, wet badges of the season's relentlessness. Your mother, no stranger to heat waves, has taken to afternoon naps in the still, silent dark. Bad as it is up here, though, it's worse, you know, far worse down in Manhattan. You gulp down a glass of water warmer than the soup, polish off a second soon as it's poured. Sometimes the songs make you so dizzy you forget where you are. You've tried every manner of patent medicine, the one that tastes like licorice, and the one that tastes like silver, the one that's made from coal ash, and the one that's made from pine resin. Neither whiskey, nor gin, nor cocaine, nor hemp, nor hashish does the trick. You can't easily get your hands on opium. Only sleep, morphine, and the unknown dulling potion the orderlies provide temporarily blotted out. Then, soon as you stir, you're back at this internal concert. On stage again inside your head is Willie Wayside performing with Billy at the Standard in Kansas City, twirling that mahogany cane and jigging at the Pekin in Savoy in Chicago, only without the corked mask and zinced lips and red wig and patchwork coats and satin lapels and tails and pop-top hat and tap shoes polished to the consistency of glass and the orchestra without the after parties and champagne breakfast without the evening ending and you being able to sleep a whole night through without these notes peeling into bedlam. Nobody knows. Why did you ever write them? Who did you write them for? Yourself and them. More than you know, you did not want to do now dare to admit these songs still reeling and unreeling, unreal daily, hourly, by the minute in you, your head, and you can't, simply cannot, can no longer bear it. Open your mouth as if you intend to swallow. You set the glass down and head for the door. Excuse me, sir, but you finished? The young man, so light, only his features, hair texture, reveal his story, murmurs politely. Can I get you anything else, sir? Send something up to your room? You pause, look him over, see the eyes catching yours. Another time, you think, shake him off, force a half smile when you catch his flash of recognition, or perhaps it's just that broader sense of a link mixed with abstract solidarity, so common wherever you see each other, our people, even if no one else fully sees you, until the stain of disdain seeps in. Perhaps the young man stood at the doorway as you regaled everyone last night with a few of the songs your fingers played from memory. Since your mind would not cooperate, you could see your mother beaming from her seat as you completed under the bamboo tree, nodding, clapping her eyes, telling you that everything was all right, although it wasn't, it isn't. Perhaps years before he saw you staring back from a handbill, contentedly, unlike now, and he too secretly blames you, they all do, for how you all are viewed. You pass into the alcove, past the check-in desk. The doorman, dark as a pneumatic tire, in elaborate livery despite the heat, swings the door open. You flinch, seeing your own face staring back, your mug never so cool or placid anymore, except in photographs, engravings, the same wide forehead, broad, slender lips, lantern eyes bearing something outward while beaming back in, making you glad no mirrors nearby, that you never saw yourself on stage, made up and masked, always masked, that awful jamble, thankfully, never captured for the Nickelodeon or a gramophone. You recover and extract the soul bill, $10 you have and some coins from amid the gold weight and the paperweight you stuffed this morning in each of your trouser pockets, and place the money in that other palm, sheathed in white cotton, beneath which you know lies a square of pink ridge with brown like your own, as your grip tenses, relaxes. The hurdy-gurdy in your head churns on. Thank you so much, sir. Shall I call you a driver, sir? The doorman asks, assuming correctly that you will not want to walk in this heat through the streets toward downtown, or perhaps you might be heading to Athens or across the river to Hudson. No, thank you, you mean to say. If you there, staves and quarter notes stalling your tongue, spilling out, you think you assure the doorman you're fine with the wave and head in the opposite direction, away from the town and river, northwest instead, over the meadow toward Maine. The first response is to struggle, but you should stifle it. On the lawn, as you pass, a seated trio is laughing. Beneath them spreads a lake of gingham. You know the couple, initially because of your stays here. Later, after time spent with them in the city and at their home, Luther and Anna, they travel down from Buffalo, where he has a general practice and also runs a local colored paper, and she teaches school. You chatted with them briefly yesterday when you got in. The other woman, pretty enough to be a movie star if colored women starred in movies, looks familiar, but you cannot place her. Gwendolyn, they introduce her, from Boston. She was here last year with her parents, the father a bishop of some sort. Now you remember, I'll bet six bits she was one of Anna's former students, you'd said to yourself before you met her then. They are trying to make that kind of introduction again. She straightens the ribbons in her loose black locks before you take her hand and drop it. She is saying something to you about your songs, your shows, as you think you hear Luther ask, why don't you join us, Bob? He and Anna nodding, she adds, we'd like that. We haven't hardly seen you since you arrived. You cannot hear what Gwendolyn is saying. It's as if someone has a trombone against your lobes, playing an ostinato, the same long, low phrase. Then the original song comes back and you feel light, almost giddy, whisper you are going to walk over to the creek. If you see yourself going along so, Luther looks at Anna. They lift themselves up to join you. You touch your hairline where the music threatens to erupt as they gather up the knives and forks, the bread and honey, the corked bottle of lemonade, place it in the basket, fold up the cloth. Luther's and Anna's manners, each as precise as they always have been, as anyone would expect of folks of their station. Gwendolyn hangs back, fanning herself, her eyes trained on you. You mean to say something about the weather, but no words emerge. Nothing about the food, the staff, your mother, Luther's suit, Anna's dress, the shade of creme anglaise, Boston, Harlem, Rosamond, or Jimmy, the Sambo Girls Company, or your other efforts, touring, business in general, Gwendolyn, in whom you'd never be interested, your other friends in New York, you would never discuss, let alone hint at, the train ride up, the last few months, years, the long winters of blue periods that have plagued you even before the music could not be turned off. Only a sound that sounds like the inside of a sound, a not whistle, a not warble, not words, a code, a cloud of could and cannot, and Luther laces his arm in yours, Anna close by on his other side, the basket on her free arm, Gwendolyn somewhere behind them, humming. Why is she humming? To live as one, she's humming one of your tunes, or is that you and the sound is escaping you, as it sometimes does, if you like a me and I like a you, as you proceed across the grass to the road. There is no way to counter the initial pain, a burning sensation, but eventually it will subside. Luther's arm slows you, stops you here at the roadside. You pause to pat your cheeks dry, your chest. The late afternoon heat is intensifying. You all pause as cars and carriages barrel by. Anna is talking again, something about her people who came up from Richmond to visit, some other folks they met during a trip to Ottawa, the ones appearing every day in Buffalo from Kentucky to Kingston, their plan cruise to Venezuela. What do you think about all the lynching so far this year? What do you think about the new National Association for the Advancement of Colored People in New York, those white liberals and our folk who belong to the upper 10? Rosamond and Jimmy know people involved with it. You do too. What do you think? Luther's agreeing with everything she says, his voice like hers softening as if to distract you. And though you cannot hear anything they're saying clearly anymore, hear anything beyond this interior echo, though you perceive somewhere in their tone something else, in the rhythms of their words, the blade of rebuke, not even friendship can hide it. You know what you did, they want to say, what you wrote, how you helped to sow this sickness even in the minds of your own. You know you did and tighten your fingers on the weights, so solid the gold, so smooth the glass. Sometimes you're up, sometimes you're down, but they are anchoring you right here. What do you think as you squeeze on the weights? What are you thinking? You do not. Gwendolyn, whose voice tinkles like a triangle slightly out of tune, has taken your elbow in her hand, fanning you as she inspects your eyes, your trembling lips. She asks if you would like a glass of water, a drink of water. Luther pats you on the back and suggests you all continue to the creek, sit on its banks briefly and rest, then return to the hotel. You want to say you were heading there anyways. The shade of the paper birches and slippery elms letting you cool off before you continue on your intended journey. You wag your head, something issuing from your insides, something that is and is not the noise buzzing in your brain, your throat, all down the column of your spine into your toes. You can almost arrest snippets. You know these songs by heart. How many times did you perform them by heart? Stand before that wall of stairs and pull everything from your heart by heart. Record them by heart. You could put on a show right now by heart, as you did last night by heart, here on this greensward by heart, anywhere you wanted to by heart, like you used to, like you did in the park by heart that night, and the man, that midnight man standing above you, just turned on his heels and ran, you squatting there and could not stop yourself, and the entire routine of a trip to Coontown came out, every single note, not one missed, and it wasn't until a small crowd out seeking just like you had surrounded you, their shapes stirring the black, that you realized where you were. Luther guides you to a spot they've picked. Gwendolyn dresses it with the gingham cloth. As your mind goes black, begin counting backwards. The years, where have they gone? 1911, 1910, 1909. Nobody knows the trouble. Finally, words erupt from you. I'm gonna go for a swim. They look puzzled. Anna is whispering, reminding her husband she did not bring her swimsuit, and you can all try tomorrow at the river, but you hurtle forward down the slope into the water. Bob, Luther is saying, Bob, and you're pantomiming. You are miming swimming, waving to them, and grinning, that wit and play acting that always got everyone, this time without the coal or charcoal corking and the floppy hat. Bob! And you do the crawl and the side stroke and the breaststroke, your arms windmilling the air. You can feel the creek water in your shoes, halfway to your knees, your drawers. If you like a me, eyes gleaming, cold, and I like a you. You can hear it now too, the creek streaming, the water, no wig or whiskers now, no polish, must have been a dream and never again. Bob, come on out. Luther is walking towards you, never again to croon a coon song, Uncle Rastus. You wave him off, the water at your chest, dreaming all the time. You tried, Bob, come on out. How you tried, but it kept leaking in. Moon, don't make me wait in vain tonight. No whistling coon no more, no cane or jig now. Oh, soul, you cut it out soon as you could, so loud the music and those voices. Bob, all this was a seeming, you ducking beneath the surface, the hot hate floating away, swimming away. No, Bob, maybe Anna now, someone crying out and crying. Gwendolyn, please go get someone from the hotel. And Mrs. Isabella, sinking, go soul, under the bamboo tree. Zulu from Matabulu, they never knew you. Blues, the true you dreaming, the true you, nobody's looking, nobody knows, no coon, no more, to live as one, they will never harm you at all, fly, soul, no coon, a man bending down into the mud, it's quick as someone when it once advised you, when you completely let go, because the surface appears tranquil beneath There's the undertow, and you shut your eyes and lay your head back, knowing the current and weights in your pockets will do most of the work. Allow the foliage below you its ready embrace, but just in case, you open your mouth because you intend to swallow, battling then defeating the impulse to struggle. You feel the first stabs of pain are bursting in your chest, no worse than the pain of that music you knew best. Eventually it will subside to this bonfire, this nightmare track on your mind. As your mind turns back into the blackness, you count backwards, joining in your song. No coon, no more, nobody knows the trouble I've seen. Nobody but Jesus. If you get there before I do, tell all of my friends I'm coming, until the music breaks into a screaming silence that, if you could describe it in a word, would be no word or note or sound at all, but fleeting, fleetingly, freeingly cold. Thank you.